Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 11th, 1999, and in the fireside room we have our presenter, which is a duo, David Messenbring and his wife Marie Jimenez, and their subject will be Foreign Faces of Faith. Now let's go to the fireside room for this session.
I think we're ready to begin here. Just a reminder that the series we're working on this week and next is called Climb Boldly, Finding God Out on a Limb. And sometimes we might consider that a scary-looking limb, or at least foreign-looking limb. Foreign would be the right theme for this evening. And it kind of operates from the assumption that all of us think of ourselves as being at the base of that tree. But God has given us a full tree, a full complement of limbs and branches that reach out into some foreign spaces. And that those are also part of the gift of the tree of life that we want to be sure to feed on. The title for the theme this evening is Foreign Faces of Faith. I'm David Messenbring and my wife, Maria Jimenez. And I will do the session together, kind of alternate back and forth, and hope that we stimulate in you some portraits of your own to share from people that have touched and grown your faith. But keeping in mind that the theme is on foreigners, really, people, non-Americans. We'll be focusing on some portraits from Africa and Latin America. And I want to begin with a disclaimer. I like very much the way Charlie always disclaims his authority when he leads us in Bible study. And I want to do the same thing because really, let's remember that what we're getting tonight is very secondhand. I mean, maybe Maria has more authenticity than I do, since she's a native of Spain and therefore a foreigner within these United States. But if we think about portraits from the global south, neither one of us really can reflect that. Neither one of us can represent those authentically. We reflect the light that we pick up, gain from such people, but they would represent themselves differently. And a good example of that is our dear friend Rosina Ampa, who was here 2 years ago this month. I'm wondering if any of you were present in the village 2 years ago this month when a nun and priest from Ghana was here? No? I put her name up on the board. She and checked before the session. She's got some 5 tapes from her week in the village in the tape library, and I would urge you to check them out because she'd be one of the first at the top of the list of the portraits we'd want to share with you. But given that she's represented herself so well in the library, in the tape library here, I don't think we'll go far into it. As part of the ministry of Seafarers House to the world view of our community, Seafarers House is a maritime ministry in Florida that we lead and about which we'll be sharing some information next week. And some of our ministry there is to merchant seafarers, but we also see that community as a resource to the worldview of the local South Florida community. And to make that point, we hosted Rosina for a week, 10 days last fall, and will again 10 days this fall, where she comes in and works with churches and Christian schools. She has a tremendous gift that comes to her from the oral tradition of Africa, to tell stories and proverbs and teach us some morality and some sort of enliven our humanity by drawing on that oral tradition. And is alive in the faith in a very inspiring to me, to us, way. So check out Rosina's stuff for a firsthand face of faith from around the world. And for the secondhand ones, I'm going to start with a few portraits from South Africa. where I lived for 2 years in 76 and 77. And a part of the world that I related closely to for another 10 years, 15 years after that, and still have good friends there. It is much as we live in hope, just nothing short of astonishing to me the way the kinds of changes that have taken place there. Not that South Africa has gone from this monstrous place to a paradise, but the changes that some people have experienced is just astonishing. Like Barney Pityana, P-I-T-Y-A-N-A. I first met Barney and his wife when they came into exile. I was in Lesotho, a little country surrounded by South Africa. And he and his wife, Dimsa, and their daughter, Loiso, fled really for fear of Barney's life. He had was an attorney, active in the Black Consciousness Movement in the mid-70s in South Africa. And after a pretty rough detention period, when the system employed the tactic of holding him under interrogation, and every time he refused to cooperate with them, beating up his brother, who was held in another cell in another place. This was a tactic that the South African Security Police used with a number of people. It didn't work the first time people were in detention, but then eventually they'd be released, they'd check notes with each other, and find out that for no reason at all, the police would just show up and beat me up. And well, when did that happen? And then you put two and two together and figured out it happened every time Barney stopped answering questions, his brother would get beat up. And eventually Barney left, went into exile, studied theology. This lawyer activist studied theology, became a priest in the Church of England, then went to the World Council of Churches to head the program to combat racism, and is today heads the Human Rights Commission for the government of South Africa, and has as his responsibility, he told us on a 24-hour visit about a year and a half ago, has as his responsibility trying to communicate to all the people of South Africa, but particularly the black majority, that they have a constitution with constitutional rights. This man whose thesis, if we summed up his philosophy in a word, and what got him into so much trouble in the mid-70s, was that Barney was very fond of saying it's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed. It's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed. And from that position flowed and flows all of his action that so animates what is a very large man with a very deep, wonderful laugh. It's a sin to allow yourself to be oppressed. We usually focus on the sin of the oppressor. Barney focused on the sin of allowing yourself to be oppressed. And from that came a lot of personal and collective liberation for him that, of course, got him in trouble with the oppressor. And now puts him in a very powerful position to teach black people who have never had any rights at all to understand that they have a constitution which guarantees them rights, and if they're not getting them, they should stand up and speak out, because to do anything less is sinful. Not all the heroes of that remarkable transition that's still occurring in South Africa are black, of course. Bears Naude, N-A-U-D-E, is an Afrikaner prophet who, about whom, and I need to find out if there are videotapes, and when we were here 3 years ago, we had some videotapes, and I think they may have been copied and might be around, in which case there's one called The Cry of Reason, which focuses on him. Bears Naude was an Afrikaner church leader. You know that in South Africa, there are two white groups, the English speakers and the Afrikaners, and apartheid, which is an Afrikaans word, was the political and religious work of the Afrikaner community and the Dutch and its Dutch Reformed Church. Bernadette rose to be head of the Dutch Reformed Church in the Transvaal, one of the most Afrikaner regions of South Africa, and then had a personal conversion experience and the courage to stick with it, and went on to become the most hated man, and most hated man in some ways in the Afrikaner community, because he had betrayed his own people by recognizing the humanity of black South African Christians. Beyers didn't stop where so many others who were concerned about black human rights. He didn't stop where so many others did. Half of all the Christians in South Africa, belong to the what we call the historical churches, the Lutherans, Episcopalians, Anglicans, Catholics, Methodists, Presbyterians. Those are really only half of the Christians in South Africa. The other half from the are called African Indigenous Churches or African Independent Churches, and will be the focus of a presentation I'll do Monday, I think it is, early next week, on African African Christianity. Beyers Naudé and almost all the historical church leaders, the Lutherans, the Anglicans, the Methodists, the Catholics, confine themselves to this group of Christians who are culturally Western in their Christianity, and say about those other Christians out there that they have gone too far, that's they've slid back into their heathen African ways under the guise of Christianity. We'll talk more about crossing that line next week. But Beyers, more than any other person, and helped me cross that line. I had read about them in my studies in this country before I went to South Africa. I got to South Africa determined to work with them, found out that was very tough to do. And after 6 months was about ready to give up on it when I met this pastoral prophet who made a few phone calls and encouraged me and said to me, basically, you will never get anything but grief from the historical church communities for paying attention to them, but if you will go the extra mile to find them, it will be the richest experience you have in your whole time in South Africa. Nothing political about those churches, except that they respected the integrity of their African tradition and thought that it was possible to use drums in a Christian worship service, even though the missionaries had taught people that that was the instrument of the devil. Beyers Naudé was banned and under house arrest for many years. He, in the film, breaks down in tears talking about the day when he was defrocked by his church because of his refusal to recant on this position that he had taken, that apartheid was contrary to the gospel. And that was unthinkable. Steve Biko was someone that Beyers took seriously. A black leader was killed in police custody in 1976, and a book of his writings will be the subject of another session next week. Starting to sound like advertising for the future here. So I won't really talk much about that portrait tonight, but Steve's closest friend, a man who was like a brother to him, is Malusi Mpumlana. And it would take me too much time to write that name on the board, and you wouldn't have anything to come up with anyway. But Malusi was once introduced by Desmond Tutu to an international Anglican meeting as my best priest. In the midst of burning townships, black townships in South Africa, in about 1986, Malusi was transferred from Cape Town to the Eastern Cape, Uitenhage, and placed in the largest parish in a very large township outside of Port Elizabeth, which is sort of the Detroit of South Africa. And when Melusi told me once that on his first Sunday, he stepped up into the pulpit and shocked his congregation in a community which was burning, literally, and where people were being killed by confrontation with the police at least weekly. There would be flare-ups and there'd be demonstrations. The police would shoot someone. There'd be a funeral or two a few days later. Then the police would attack the funeral participants, and then the whole cycle would sort of repeat itself on and on and on. The townships were burning. And he was taking over leadership of this massive parish, and he stood up in the pulpit and said, "I'm not here to be your minister. I'm here to enable our collective ministries. I'm not here to be your minister. I'm here to enable your ministries." With a foresight that there was no way he would be able to begin to meet the needs of that community. He approached his leadership in that church with a responsibility to empower the ministry of all those in the congregation, something that we talk about often, don't always do, but something that has had a direct impact on the life of Maria and me. When we arrived in the port that we serve in South Florida a few years ago, eight years ago next month, we quickly realized that we would be overwhelmed by the needs and not begin to meet them unless we adopted that philosophy that Melusi articulated. And so someone asked me last night, "I suppose you go visit the ships." And I said, "Well, actually, I don't." And I'm always kind of embarrassed to say that I don't. But that our philosophy has been not to do the ministry so much as to enable the ministry of a lot of other people. And it's only because of that 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 place has gone from being one of the newest port chaplaincies to now the largest in the country in just 8 years, with 150 volunteers and 35 employees, from what 8 years ago was just one. So I recommend you sleep on that notion that there's a difference between being the minister and enabling the ministries of others that Melusi so well represents. On a lighter side, I love the man because he has such a tremendous optimism about humanity. And he's got the loudest laugh of anybody I know. And he'll just do this booming laugh and then say, "I've learned that sooner or later, everybody's going to disappoint me. Look at my wife, Toko. Even her disappoints me at times. So I try to always expect disappointment from all the people that I meet and know. And then when they do something I like, I can celebrate it. And when they disappoint me, I expect it, so it doesn't spoil my day." Melusi has gone from being a tortured, during a detention experience in the mid-80s, while an activist, a community organizer, he had a vision that worried his colleagues for its intensity. I mean, he came out of detention saying that he had had a vision that God was calling him to a ministry of reconciliation among all South Africans. And he put it in such, sounded almost fundamentalist sounding theological language that the people who knew him best were concerned that he had snapped inside under pressure. Those who have watched him over the last 20 years know that he did have a very profound experience. He went to seminary. He turned the most progressive seminary in South Africa on its heels. He came in saying, "I'm here to study pastoral theology." And they said, "Well, we have this pastoral theology department." He went and checked it out. And he came back and said, "There's nothing in there about pastoring communities in crisis." And in the end, he redesigned the whole curriculum for the seminary on practical theology. The whole South African system was designed to restrict black people who were too active by using these identity cards and banning them to certain locations. And he had such a complex history of identity cards that only he knew. That he had a whole drawer full of different ones, and every time one of them got burned out, he'd bring out another one, and he always had this warm, smiling, charismatic way of talking to the security police about, oh, no, you just don't understand. I really do have permission to be here. And he would go back and forth across the borders where they were trying to restrict him all the time. Malusi today heads the Africa programs for the Kellogg Foundation, one of the largest and richest foundations in the world, and in that capacity he is spent responsible for investing literally millions of dollars in Southern Africa, not just South Africa. And that's to me a very hopeful thing, because I think that when you marry good leadership with financial resources, a lot can happen. Malusi Mbumwana, my favorite South African. Malusi and his wife Toka were invited to Brazil by a couple of people, Lilia Azevedo and Frei João, Father John, a Catholic priest, I think a Dominican priest, and a devoted lay woman who works closely with Frei João. These two have a ministry to the middle class consciousness of Brazil. Lily is a Brazilian. And John has been, his whole ministry as a Catholic priest has been in Brazil. They had a program for a while, a South-South exchange program, bringing South African church leaders to Brazil and moving them around the country of Brazil so that Brazilians would learn about South Africa, the situation in South Africa, from South Africans. And Malusi and Toko went to Brazil once and then came back through New York where they stayed with me for a few days before heading home to South Africa. And when they came back from Brazil, they said this Biko book that we're going to focus on next week, and that'll be in the bookstore soon, any day now. They want to publish a Portuguese edition of that. So that gave me an entree to start working with Lilia and Frei João and learn about their ministry to the middle class in Brazil. Now, Brazil is a huge country with tremendous poverty, and for the most part, people who are concerned about the justice situation in Brazil focus directly on working with the poor. Frei João and Lilia focus on conscientizing, changing the consciousness of middle class, like white, mostly white middle class people. And in that capacity, they used the Biko book and got to know, and us through them, a young woman named Mev Puleo, who died very tragically a couple of years ago from a brain tumor at the age of about 30. But before she died, gave us a book that I've written up there that Robert McCaffrey Brown says in the first line of his preface. If I were to choose a single book by means of which to introduce North Americans to the real meaning of liberation theology, it would be this book. That's strong language coming from a well-known author. And we're going to quote some portraits. What Mev does in this book, which is maybe 17, 16 chapters, it just focuses on different church leaders, in quote. Some are peasant women, some are liberation theologians like Leonardo Boff and his brother, and with wonderful photography, and then a little introduction to the person in italics. She then had a style of interviewing people which just verbatim gives you their words. And I'd like to read to you, it wouldn't put you to sleep, quickly, excerpts from four of the people focused in there, and then Maria's going to give us some different portraits, and she'll do some more reading from these. Salome Costa is, as Mev tells us, a feminist and free thinker who longs to study theology, and if the Catholic Church allowed it, would seek to become a priest. Like many other people of faith with few material resources, her education comes mostly from Bible meetings, grassroots workshops, and seminars. Although Salome hasn't studied formal theology, she claims to speak the theology of, quote, daily life itself, In the summer of 1990, she was invited to participate in a national meeting of 67 women theologians. And she recounts, quote, "They spoke above my head, but as incredible as it seems, I didn't feel diminished by their knowledge. They have intellectual understanding, but I have the practice, the experience." And Salome says, "Our baptism is a commitment. Each time we discover the commitment we have as Christians, each time we discover the commitment that we have as Christians, we can no longer say, I go to church to find peace. I don't think I'll find much peace there. Because when you know that someone doesn't have food, another doesn't have a house, it creates a conflict inside of you. We do encounter the strength of God in church, but it's not this peaceful peace that keeps you quiet and sends you home. And the God we encounter inspires us to struggle against these things that create conflict. We're struggling so that others can have peace, housing, and work, and food. We're searching for life itself. You see, the reign of God has to start right here. When no one has food, when no one has a house, when no one can go to school, then the reign of God isn't happening. God is present when we search for these things here and now. That's how the reign of God begins." In another section she writes, she says, "You see, when you discover faith, you're involved in politics. That is, when you're searching for life, you're engaged in a political act." And finally, on the question of, do you think people who were born on the wealthier and more privileged side of society also need God's liberation? Salome says, "I think rich people have a great emptiness. In spite of having and buying everything, if they don't share their wealth, they'll feel very empty. The gospel says how difficult it is for a rich person to save him or herself. Rich people don't want to share. They only want to donate out of their surplus. They don't want to share. They only want to donate out of their surplus." That hit me right in the gut. "It isn't a sin to have wealth if you share your goods." And finally, on the same subject of what you would say to these privileged people, Salome says, "If you look at the gospel, you'll discover that God is always on the side of the smallest. So we never feel alone. We're always in the presence of God. I am a home of God." This is a beaten down, much oppressed peasant woman. "I am a home of God. God is present in each one of us. God comes to us and uses us to serve others. Yes, we must allow God to work through us to serve others. I pray that we always feel this presence of God in our lives." In the same neighborhood, we're told by Mev of Salome, is a man named Edilson Herculano da Silva, who for a while ran a broom-making cooperative and now works for a religious publisher in Brazil. And on the subject of what he would say to people in the first world, Edison says, "I want to tell our wealthy brothers and sisters that salvation doesn't come only for the poor, but yes, for the rich as well. Because of this, I plead that you all share a little. Share a little bit of your wealth, your happiness, your knowledge. I also believe that the poor have a lot to share with the rich. I believe that the poor have more to share with the rich than the rich have to share with the poor. Our God is so marvelous that whoever walks with God has everything to share with everyone." And then listen here. "Whoever walks only for himself dies without leaving regret in anyone's heart." Whoever walks only for himself dies without leaving regret in anyone's heart. Another woman from the favelas who's on fire with service to her neighborhood, but not from a middle-class position, from a peasant position, says briefly on the subject of what she would say to the North, to people living in the North. "Above all, people should believe in God. We can't make a universe, and we can't give the very gift of life," Surely there's a superior being. I wonder about those who say they don't believe in God. What do they believe in? They have to believe in something. What is it? Some people believe in money and live as if money is God, but that's not true. God isn't money or power. God carries our image, our likeness. A big agenda of this book is to talk about the impact that the base Christian communities have had in Brazil before the Vatican started trying to shut them down in the early 90s. And there's often conversation between Mev and the people she's talking with about the impact of that. But what comes through as you read it very strongly is the results. These lay people, and Maria will quote on the subject of lay leadership by the next woman I'm going to quote from a little bit later. What a transformation has taken place among those who learned to read the Bible for themselves and to respect that God lives in me, a peasant woman, and therefore I have a big agenda that I'm about. It's a very empowering, exciting thing, and a testimony to what the Vatican may not be able to stop that as they think. One of the most articulate people in this book, in my opinion, is a woman out in the Marabá region who has a high school education only and works as a high school teacher and is the single mother of an adopted child. And she writes, she speaks very articulately on what it means to be black, to be a woman, and to be a Christian. And on the and says this: we know that the majority of the rich aren't exactly liberated either. They're slaves to money, ambition, and power. Their money makes them slaves to fear of change, because they fear that they too will have to live in misery. They sleep worrying about their company earning or losing money. Beyond this, they think they'll lose all of their friends if they go down in social class. The more people own, the more enslaved they are. That's a collection of some things from some of the Brazilians portrayed in this book on the subject of what they would say to us in the North. And with that, I'm going to be quiet for a minute and share with my partner here some other portraits.
And are we going to have a time to from here to hear from them? Okay. Well, I start. We were talking yesterday about the encounters we are fortunate so to have with the people whom we work, and that's men and women from all over the world that come to our port in South Florida. That's Port Everglades. And that reminds me how privileged I am in having what I have, in living where I live, and it's a constant reminding of what my duties are and my faith, and it's a good exercise. I'm thinking especially of Carlos, who said in my country, in my family, among the poor, we cannot rest, because if we rest, we die. And that is very, very powerful, because I really need my nap sometimes. I need to take time for recreation, and to conceive that as a luxury, because other people, to have that will mean death. It's hard to comprehend, but I believe because the necessity is so great in Central America, in Honduras, where he was coming from, that he shared the story of having to pay a lot of money to come to work on a ship, and it took about 3 years to invest and to prepare himself and his family for this project to come to work on a ship. And while on a ship, he's lonely and he's missing his family, and he misses the suffering, he says, the suffering from Honduras. And I couldn't understand. I said, why? He says, because the more I suffer, the closer I am to God, and the more I need God. So there was this connection between suffering and being close to God and depending on God, that maybe he was forgetting it, how much his way of life in Honduras was related to God. So that and other aspects of people who simply share their faith, like Tito. Tito was from Guatemala, and he comes and says, well, I have problems in sleeping, because at night when it's my time to rest, in my cabin, other people come and start and get up and put their radio or smoke cigarettes, so I never have a chance to sleep well. He works on a ship, on a cruise ship, in the dishwashing, cleaning pots. And I was thinking today, well, 3 years ago I was volunteering the dishwashing and I was cleaning pots, and how noisy it can be and how tough. Well, this man works from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. cleaning pots every day of the year. So again, it's a stretch to try to put myself in his shoes. Doing that is out of my comprehension. How would I be? Then I said, well, what do you do in Guatemala before you came? And he says, I was a school teacher. But my family is so poor, so extremely poor that we couldn't survive with the $200 a month that I was earning. So I had to come. And I saw again Tito sacrificing himself for the sake of the family. I have my doubts that they're going to do better here with other families and their support, to make a little bit more money. I'm always trying to reflect what is behind, who are leaving them, who are their families and where they're coming from, because the life so dehumanized they are here, apart from their roots, it's not worth the money, I think. But for me, it's again hard to say, because I'm not poor. But Tito was giving up his family and his home for the sake of others, and remind me the text of Mark that says, take up your cross and follow me. And that's again another portrait of the gospel, how God talked to us in real people, in real experiences. And there is David was talking here before about a quote from a Dutch theologian who's working in Brazil. Page 125. says, "The poor have a great humanity. There is such happiness that you don't know where it comes from. There is a sense of justice, of sharing, of faith. This is all in the midst of poor people whose lives are terribly dehumanized. For example, one time a poor person said to me, 'When I move to the city, I have the greatest sorrow when I pass a poor person begging. And I don't have anything to give him. I go and hide in my house so he won't see my face. The worst thing in the world is to have nothing to share with a person poorer than myself.'" And another quote from this woman who David just was talking about, the one that adopted a baby, and she was a high school teacher. "And the church must continue giving space to the laity. Before, only priests or nuns would be involved. At this stage of liberation theology, the lay people have to make their own history. You see, a priest is here for 5 years and then moves on. But the lay person stays here, involved in the movements, the unions, etc. The struggle goes on even when the priest leaves. Faith sustains me in this struggle. The example of Christ, the liberator, who taught us how to struggle for life. Without faith, all my works would be meaningless. I am motivated by a certain mysticism. An interior force shakes me up deeply before the bad things happening in our world. Many people don't feel this way. When I'm discouraged, I look to Christ, the source of my strength. The Bible is so important for us. It gives us courage. Prayer is also very important. It strengthens the spirit. But we can leave aside the action. Our word for prayer is orasao, which means ora, to pray, and sao, action. Prayers alone don't help. You have to pray and participate. I really believe that God listens to our prayers, but we can't wait for answers to fall from heavens. We have to pray to God, believing God will hear, but we have to do something too. If we don't, things will never change. I believe what Gandhi wrote. Those who say religion doesn't have anything to do with politics don't understand religion. Faith and politics essentially go together. I don't mean political parties. I mean every time you take to the streets to demand water, housing, healthcare, this is politics. The very Bible contains politics. Jesus denounced the great injustice of the powerful people of his time and defended the little people. Because of this, the powerful people of his time crucified him. The Bible isn't just about the past. It's happening now. Pharaoh isn't that different from our large landowners. Now you have to interpret the Bible. If you don't, you will use the Bible like the evangelical fundamentalist. They use the Bible only for private prayer, but they don't see the action that is implicit in it. For us, Scripture is like a light that illuminates our journey. But if you just sit and stare at the light, you will ruin your eyesight. So that's a very profound statement. And I pray God that than I have, and learn from them. So my faith is always alive.
I want to very quickly share two portraits from two Anglican bishops in Africa, very brief one, that I met working as a grant maker for an Episcopal Trinity Church Wall Street, and would go to Africa three times a year for 6 weeks at a time and meet with church leaders, ecumenical or Anglican, who were looking for funding for their work. One taught us, I traveled with my boss to Zimbabwe once, and we met this bishop who had a reputation for doing great stewardship work. And we went into his diocese and observed on a Sunday morning how the parishes had learned to support themselves. He said to us, "My people don't have cash. They're very poor, they're peasant farmers. But this one has got a few chickens that lay eggs, and this one has got some produce from their garden. And so I encourage them to bring the fruits of their labors to church on Sunday morning. And after church, every Sunday morning, we hold auctions. And when we sell the eggs, we say, 'These are not eggs like you find in the market, these are church eggs.'" And so people should pay more for them, and he says, they do. And those churches support themselves with auctions from in-kind donations of the membership. A good lesson for us on stewardship. Another bishop in Zambia we met impressed me so much with the young people that filled his house and his staff and were just, if you've ever met African Christians, in that classic way, on fire with love for Jesus. But not in the, in what Maria read a few minutes ago, the kind of non-active evangelical fundamentalist sense. For example, he said to us, in terms of the funding that he wanted, he said, "What I need most is help with my evangelism program." And we said, "Well, that's not really one of our program emphasis." He said, "No. If you will give me a well, that's what I need for evangelism." He said, and he named in a minute several villages that had no source of water. You know that half of the people in the world walk for their water, which is why most of the world thinks of rich people as those with running water in their homes. Doesn't have to be hot. And in this village, where there was no church of any kind, of any denomination, and no water source, he asked us for funds to sink a well right in the middle of the village. And he said, "If you will provide the funds for me to put three wells in three villages and come back in 3 years, I promise you I'll show you three new churches." There is, not all over Africa, but in many places, a tremendous orientation of the church to evangelism that is based on a concern for meeting the needs of people. Unlike a pastor I spoke with today in the village who told me that he lost a number of people in his rural Midwest parish when they opened a preschool in a town that has a tremendous shortage of preschool. You wouldn't think, I mean, some of us, that's become a basic activity of churches whereby we meet the needs of the local community, but I was surprised to hear that it's still, for some, a radical gesture. And he said that preschool is now self-supporting 3 years later and has a waiting list of people to get in who want to witness to meeting the needs of the community, and what a good style of doing evangelism. A Lutheran pastor interviewed in this book is Lori Altman, one of, I think it says there were about 40 out of 800 of the Lutheran pastors in Brazil are women. And Lori Altman in particular, Pastor Altman, is known for a radical identification with indigenous people. She and her husband went out to the forests and lived with people in the forests. Actually, her second child was born according to the local customs of the Indians among whom they lived. And in her interview, she talks about how she's evolved her sense of how you identify with people. But as someone who's interested in the mission of the church and mission theology, these paragraphs struck me particularly. Lutheran theology is always centered on the question of sin and grace. The language of indigenous groups of the Indians she had lived among didn't even have the concept of sin. Then I understood that all these Lutheran conflicts, sin and justification, which may have been important for Luther's era, had nothing to do with these people. Sin is not theirs, but ours as white people. Ours is a historical sin, starting the moment we invaded this continent. As Christians, we supported the process of colonization and occupation of this land and these peoples. So it wasn't a matter of us teaching the Indians about sin and justification through Christ. This isn't framed right. We don't need to discover where sin is among them, but where it is among us, as Christians, as whites, on an indigenous continent. I support a, quote, silent mission. We sin so much in bringing sickness, death, robbery of land, and cultural destruction that we have little good news to share. The original meaning of evangelization is good news, but this Christian message arrived as bad news, accompanied by death and domination. To be redeemed from this historical sin, we must be silent before the Indians. We need to place ourselves beside them without expecting any profit, even the profit of converts.